Well, you did have to wait a little while for part two. Tonight is the Oscars, and so I thought that was very appropriate. My wife and I really look forward to every year going to see yet another installment in the Lord of the Rings series, and it's every year. So waiting only a month or so, not so bad. Because it is Oscar night, I felt compelled that I bring you a movie reference. And so I actually wrote the sermon and then was desperate. And then it suddenly came to me on the way in this morning. So the movie reference, and you can, I'll not tell you how it matches up until we go through it. But the movie reference is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Because I'm an archaeologist and that movie has something to do with religion in some sort. And it's about Hollywood. So we'll see how it fits together. The last time we looked at the creation story in the book of Genesis, by the way, we will be in Genesis, easy book to find, very right at the beginning, and we looked at the creation story in chapters 1 and the first part of 2, and we answered the question, why are we here, with a few different answers. We saw that according to the text of Genesis, chapters 1 and 2, we are created to, one, be the representatives of God on earth, like the ancient kings of the ancient Near East. Two, we are to be like God in that sense, making and maintaining order out of chaos. Three, we are to be fruitful and multiply and fillify the earth. And four, that we are tasked very specifically with taking care of the place. We are to guard and cultivate the garden, the planet, the creation that God has given us. So that's a pretty tall order. Yet, as was just noted, there's more to this question. We could ask the question, why are we here? Or we could ask the question, why are we here? In other words, we can ask it from the perspective not of purpose, why are we here? The last sermon, but rather of consequence. How did we end up here? How did we get into this less than perfect state that we find ourselves in? That's what I'd like to talk about this morning. And I think we'll find the answer to this question not too terribly far from where we were before, focusing in on Genesis chapter 3. But we do have to start, oh, my classes always love this too. Let's back up a little bit and catch our story exactly where we left off last time. We left off in chapter 2, verse 14. Actually, nothing is going to appear up there. It's all from the text. I have no pretty pictures of archaeology or anything, so we'll just move along. You have the text in front of you. We're going to walk through it. That said, we don't have all day to walk through it, so certain things I will simply kind of gloss over in the sermon. You may say, but wait a minute, I have a question about that. Great. That room right over there, right after church, is the place where we will talk about all the things that, well, maybe not all the things, most of the things that we're not able to talk about in here. Because sermons are different than Sunday schools in terms of genre, and the sermon needs to keep moving forward rather than getting lost. Otherwise, if you're willing to stay, we'll have a sermon that, you know, but I think the other church would be a little miffed if we never left. So that would be a problem. So we begin right where we left off in 2:14 and move right into 2:15. So Yahweh Elohim took the human, and you'll notice that your version is a little different than mine because my version is, wait for it, my version. This is my translation. And so you probably won't find it in your Bibles unless I just magically got the same. Took the human and settled him in the Garden of Eden, the Garden of Delightfulness, to cultivate it and preserve it. And that kind of ends our first story. Again, think in terms of narratives and how stories work. That's the end of the first story. Then you get something that is a really good narrative device wherever you find it. It's called foreshadowing. What happens next in our story? And we'll take a moment to talk about it. Then Yahweh Elohim commanded the human. So right after he creates him, gives him a task, gives him a purpose, he then gives a command. right away. Okay. From every tree of the garden you may, and in the Hebrew there are certain forms of the verbs that I've tried to really focus on in my translation. From every tree of the garden you may most certainly eat, but from the tree of knowledge, tov vera'ah. Anybody have that in your Bibles? No, that's the Hebrew. We'll talk about that in a moment. Tov vera'ah, do not ever eat from it, because on the very day you eat of it, you will really, really die. You will most certainly die. So there's the command. We're very used to that command. We've heard it all. You know, anybody who's read the Bible, yeah, we hear about it. But let's look at it for just a second. First of all, I'm not going to answer the question of why would God put a tree in the garden that they can't touch? We'll talk about that in Sunday school if you'd like to do that. It's an important question, and it gets asked a lot. Why would you do that? Secondly, okay, how many have had children, have babysat children, have watched what small children do when you tell them, hey, play in this room, but you can't touch that toy right there? Yes, you get it. We are very used to viewing this text theologically so much that we miss the story. This is very clearly foreshadowing. Every reader who reads this text knows exactly what's going to happen at some point. There is no doubt in anyone's mind that someone is going to play with that tree. It's a guarantee. And it's good writing that we set that up. And then you'll notice that we leave it alone. We don't talk about that for a while. It's kind of like in the murder mysteries that you watch. See, movies are our references today. The murder mysteries that you watch, they'll put something in all way over here, and then they'll just leave it alone. And they'll do their movie. And then way over here, they'll say, oh yeah, remember that? It's a marvelous way to tell a story. This has a little bit more to it in terms of the story. Who is there when God says this? Yeah, the man. We won't get to him actually having a name, Adam, until a few chapters later. He is constantly called the human. And that Adam, we saw last time, Adam comes from the dirt. Dirt is Adama. Adam is the guy made out of dirt. Congratulations, you're all dirt people. That's what we are. The human is made out of the dirt. And so Adam is the only one there. Just file that away. So, whatever this command is, it revolves around this one tree, which is in the midst or somewhere in the garden. And they're not supposed to eat it ever, ever, ever. That's the Hebrew. The type of Hebrew there is never touch, never eat this tree. Eat from this tree. Never, never. Because when you do, on that day, you will really, really die. So what is this tree? Well, it's the tree of Tov Vera'ah. You all know that, right? Somebody explain that to me. No, I won't make you do that. Tov, it means good. Ra'ah means detrimental, problematic. Sometimes it has evil attached to it. You are used to hearing this, good and evil. When we hear evil, we attach morality to it, a moral bad thing. That's not what this is about. This is knowledge of good stuff and detrimental stuff, beneficial stuff and problematic stuff. It's the two sides of the coin. Just to let you know how this works, throughout the Hebrew Bible, God does ra'ah. He does the detrimental. He does the problematic. So it cannot simply mean morally evil, and it doesn't here. So what is it about? Well, in this case, the tree is the tree of knowledge. You learn stuff. You learn good stuff, and you learn bad stuff. You learn things you smile about and things you frown about. You learn things that help you and things that hurt you. That's the knowledge that's discussed here. So, we have God saying, don't get that knowledge. Don't you eat of it. I don't know what his plan was, whether we were never supposed to have the knowledge, whether he was going to give it to us another. I simply don't know. The text does not tell us. But the text says, God said, don't touch that tree. Little children, don't play with that toy. That's important to see. The tree itself is not bad. And often we think the tree is about, it's evil. No, the tree is about gaining knowledge. And to push it one step further, in the Hebrew Bible, this knowledge of good and not so good, this good and bad, whatever you want to do with it, implies wisdom. You gain in a further, deeper understanding of the way things work. If you kick a big sleeping dog, is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's a bad thing usually, because the dog will then turn and bite you. We'll see how all that works in a moment. So do we have that kind of set? That's the command. Don't touch this tree. Actually, I keep doing that. Don't eat from this tree ever, ever, ever. And this is what the tree is. It gives you knowledge. Okay. So then after that little turn, so we've had the end of the first story. We've got this little command stuck in this wonderful foreshadowing that everybody knows somebody's going to deal with the tree. And then we move on to the beginning of the second story. And it's a second story here in chapter 2 of God needing something. Remember we saw in chapter 1, God needed a gardener before he could plant. So he created a gardener and then he was able to plant stuff. Now what does God need? Well, in 2:18 it says, then Yahweh Elohim says, it is, everybody look down, it is what? Not good. Oh, how many have noticed that before in the creation story? What has chapter 1 always said? It's good, it's good, it's good, it's very good. Now we have something that God says, oh, this is not good. Once again, good is not a moral determinant. It's rather benefit, propriety, the way it should be. That good also in the Hebrew Bible means pretty. Moses looked good. He was pretty. David was a pretty boy. It's the same word. It's a broader word, and we would love in this chapter especially to hook morality to it. We can't do that. That's not the intent here. So God says, this is not what I had in mind, that this human be alone. He needs a companion. I will then make for him an Ezer as its counterpart. Ezer, congratulations, you all sung that word this morning. Who can tell me where? There you go. Here I raise my Ebenezer, stone of help. The word means help. And it's not a lower level, because God himself describes himself as an Ezer. He is our help. So I'm going to create something that counterparts, that companions, to make the man not be alone. Now, the next story, the story as it continues, is fairly interesting, and we can discuss it in Sunday school because it could take a long time. So God sets out to give the guy a companion. Notice that he does not go, companion, and there's one there. Instead, he does something kind of odd. He says, okay, animals, line up and bring him before, and the man looks, at the human looks, and he keeps looking, and he names, and he does all this stuff. God is trying out every animal, and none of them work. Squid, zebra, none of them work. And so, what we see in this is the human is actually kind of like other animals. We saw in chapter 1 that he's different, but he's kind of like other animals. We're giving this a shot. So we see the human both as an animal and as something better or different than an animal in this item. So, and we also see that God is trying something. And how does that work? Does he find an animal? No, he doesn't actually. He doesn't find an animal. So he realizes, well, okay, I got to do something else. So then he creates the Ezer, and we're familiar with that. We can talk about that. He makes Adam go to sleep, and then he does some surgery. So there you are. Now he's doing surgery. So he's this is an amazing God who does all kinds of ways to create stuff in this chapter. And he creates something called an Isha. Ish is the Hebrew word for man, male, a male person, a man. And Isha is female. That kind of, I don't know how it works in Chinese languages, but in many languages, the feminine form is an ah sound at the end of a masculine word. If you hang out with Spanish-speaking people, very common that that's how that works. French, a lot of the Romance languages, a lot of other languages do that as well. So now we have an Adam, a human, and he'll continue to be called that, but we're going to have the human identity broken into two parts, an Ish and an Isha. So now we've got two. So we've got two, and then we have at the end of chapter two, which I'll tell you right now, I think is a very bad place to break the chapter. We have a summary statement about what's going on. Look at 2:25. Now the two of them were naked, the human and his Isha, and yet they were not ashamed. Everybody's got pretty much that same thing. Okay. There's a pun in here, and I'll get to that in a moment. But think about that. Now, I have a dog. I love my dog. I do not put clothes on my dog. You might do that. I don't want to hear about it. I don't do that. My dog is naked, and she doesn't care. She's not ashamed. Think about, so animals function that way. What else functions that way? Or who else functions that way? And don't think nudists. Huh? Yes, small children tear off their clothes all the time. It's just what they do because they're naked and not ashamed. Why am I wearing this stuff for? This is dopey. So think about that. We've had a story that kind of equates humans to animals in terms of let's find a counterpart, but yet not. And now we have a statement that here you have people who are kind of animal-like or really childlike. Notice it's not about being perfect. We often will put, and we can talk more about garden becoming paradise in Sunday school, we often put the world before chapter 3 as the perfect world for a variety of reasons. It's just more of a, can I say it, innocent world? Naive world? They don't, what tree aren't they supposed to touch? The tree that gives them knowledge, Tov Vara'a. And they don't even know they're naked. They're like little kids. They're like my dog. Now, isn't that great? So there's the picture for what's going on. Now look at, now forget that there's a chapter break there. Forget there shouldn't be a chapter break there. I'm going to critique the rabbis. Now look at the next phrase, which seems to begin a new story, but is intimately connected with the verse that just came. Yet the snake was the most, and now just whatever your versions say, we'll get to that word in a moment, was the most something of every wild animal that Yahweh Elohim had made. Now, here's the pun. For to be naked is to be arumim in Hebrew. Arumim. To be the most, whatever it is that the snake is to be arum. It's a pun in the Hebrew. It's designed to make you see both of those sentences in contrast with each other. So what you have here is the humans were innocent, naive, kind of like my dog. The snake was what? He was the most something of every wild animal. He's not called Satan here. He's not Satan in this story. That's not a connection that's made here. Again, we can talk about that in Sunday school. But this is the snake, and he's the most something. Now, I like Sunday school. Give me some words that your translations have for what the snake is most. Crafty. Oh, yeah, I know. Anybody else have anything other than crafty? Crafty, is it a good word? When you think about it, is it a good thing or a bad thing? Ah, it depends on how you use it. Yes, indeed. Because I know people who are crafty and they make crafts. The word here can mean crafty. It can also mean clever. It has a broad variety of meanings, and the word is almost always used in the Hebrew Bible as a positive attribute. We are to be clever. Clever people get what they need. Clever people can get you to do what they want you to do. Jacob is very Arum. Jacob is clever. You may want him to be crafty. And various versions of this verse will put in there the word they want to make you, the reader, think the way they want you to think. So they may want you to think the snake is the bad guy. I think the snake is the bad guy. But the word in the Hebrew is he's the most of all of these animals. He's the most clever of all the animals. That will be, and that's the word I would choose. That will be important in a little bit. But notice how verse 2:25 and 3:1 form a nice antithetical parallel. The people are innocent and naive. The snake is the most clever. Now, what's going to happen when the snake and the people meet? Innocent and naive meet clever. What's going to happen there? And that's the story that we get into now, as really all of that was the four. That was the introduction to the story of what happens. So we have a command, don't touch, or don't deal with it. I keep doing that, sorry. We have a command. We've got kind of naive and innocent people who don't have knowledge of Tov V'ra'ah yet. And we've got a really clever animal. Now, notice what happens at the very beginning of the next. And he said to the Isha. Okay. Nobody jumped up and said, huh? You got a talking snake here. Anybody notice that? Now, we would laugh, and most readers would laugh, a talking snake, something odd is going on here. Of course, we're in this primordial odd world, that's fine. So what we'd want to check for as a reader is not our response to it, but the other characters' responses to it. That's how literature, that's how stories work. So if I respond, boy, that's dumb, that can't happen, you know, or whatever I might, that's of no real consequence. It's how the characters respond. So what does Eve say, or the woman, the Isha, say about the talking snake? Very good. It is of no consequence to her. It is perfectly natural to her that a snake talks to her. We can talk about that in Sunday school, but that's the story. The story does not have her going, oh my goodness! Or, like Balaam and the donkey that God allowed to speak, hey, what are you doing here? Yeah, it's not a weird thing for her. This may imply that there was a fine relationship between animals and people. Yeah, it might. All the animals had wandered before Adam, just kind of cruising around, and that's okay, you're a zebra, you're a lobster, okay, whatever. And he did this. So we already, in the beginning of this, have some sort of a relationship that's not bizarre. It may be bizarre to us, but in the narrative world, not bizarre. Perfectly normal. So He says to the Isha, is it really the case that Elohim said, do not ever eat from any tree of the garden? What does the snake know? Well, the snake knows something about what was told to Adam. Are we told how the snake knows? Nope. Are we told why the snake cares? Nope. We just have to give the snake exactly, we have to give the story exactly what it asks of us. The snake knows. There it is. In reading narrative, you must give them what they ask for. I think I've used this before in here, but since it's movie day, we'll do it again. Star Wars. If you hang out watching Star Wars saying, oh, lightsabers can't happen, you're going to miss the story. You have to give Lucas or whoever, J.J. Abrams or whoever's doing it now, you have to give them lightsabers or the story don't work. You must say, okay, I guess the snake knows. All right, fair enough. So the snake knows. And the snake is saying something different than we, the reader, heard God say to Adam. Adam, it's different. Already then, this clever fellow, we're now kind of going, is he mistaken? Or is he trying to pull something here? That's how we read this. Okay. The Isha then answers, from the fruit of the trees of the garden we eat, but from the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, I guess it's in the middle then, Elohim said, do not ever eat from it and do not touch it, or else you will surely die. I don't know how many sermons and papers I've heard on, see, she adds to what God had said. Well, as a reader, we know she added to what God had told Adam. What had God told her? Very good. We don't know. We have no clue what he told her or what Adam told her or how she found out. We know she knows the rule. We don't know anything more than that. Your author, though, is pushing us. Because we, the reader, say, wait a minute, that's not quite right. So the snake didn't get it quite right, and she's not getting it quite right. But her motivation is still pretty good. And it's a very human motivation. Human beings tend to back up one step. That's what we do. I'm not allowed to do this, so I'm also not going to do this because that'll put me close to this. That's the way humans function. It just is. I'm not allowed to have 10 cookies because it'll make me fat, so I won't have any cookies. Could have one cookie. They're good. No. 10 will make me fat, so I'm not going to have any. Or if you remember from TV years ago, Tim the Toolman Taylor, if a little bit of power tool is good, a giant power tool must be better. It's just the way it is. So, the snake then, after she responds, says to the Isha, you will not most certainly die. And it's exactly the same phrase that we had seen in God's word to the human. You will not most certainly die. For Elohim knows that on the day, and so we have it's now a comparison, you will not die on that day. On that day instead, here's what's going to happen. You will become like Elohim, knowing Tov from Ra'ah. Now, I ask this question, we'll answer it in Sunday school. Does the snake lie? We want the snake to be a big, fat, filthy liar. He's not. He's presenting a new option for the human. And what's the human like? Innocent, naive, unknowing Tov and Ra'ah. What does the human know? The human knows, don't touch that tree. That's what the human knows. Why? Because it's a bad thing. We'll die. Okay. That's all she knows. So, you will not most certainly die, says the snake. For Elohim knows that on the day you eat of it, you will become like Elohim himself, or gods. We can play with that. Knowing good, knowing Tov and Ra'ah. Then, in the Hebrew, Then the Isha saw, just make a mental note of that for a second, saw that it, the tree, the fruit, was tov. She understood, okay, it's tov for food, and a delight worth craving it was to the eyes, and the tree was desirable to give insight. She saw with her eyes to get insight. Anybody see the cleverness of the author? Because what's going to go on, if you look a little bit down further, once they, and then she took the fruit, she ate, she gave it to her husband. We'll talk about that in a second. But notice what happens to them, according to the text, as soon as they eat. The eyes of the two of them were opened, and now they knew that naked were they. So she saw something, but once they ate, her eyes were open. And again, in the Hebrew Bible, this is the idea of gaining knowledge or gaining wisdom. She got exactly what she thought she would get. Let that sink in for a minute. That's what she got. She gave it to her Ish, who was with her. Apparently, right there. So why isn't he saying anything? Well, because he is as responsible as she. He's standing right there. She hands it to him. They both eat. Their eyes are open. They become aware. They become no longer innocent, naive people. They now know what? Tov and Ra'ah. Okay. Notice how this happened. And this is the first of, why are we here? She made a decision. Don't miss that. She heard about what it might do. She saw, she looked, she decided. That is human responsibility. She made a choice. Snake didn't trick her. Snake actually told her the truth. She made a choice. This is what I want rather than this. All she knew is God said don't, and she knew what the snake offered. Humans make choices all the time. The heart is the seat of decision making in Hebrew literature. All of those comments you hear about the heart being deceitful. Yeah, your heart will trick you. I bet you've made at least 75 choices today already. We make choices. You got out of bed. There's one. You turned off the alarm. There's another. You brushed your teeth. I hope. There's another. You make choices all the time. Some choices are easy to make. Brushing your teeth, I hope, is one of those. Some choices are difficult to make, and some choices are pretty near impossible to make. For a drug addict to choose not to take drugs is a very, very hard choice. One that may be pretty near impossible. For you to choose whether or not to pick up that candy bar from the liquor store and put it in your pocket and walk out should be a real easy choice. Should be an easy choice whether to insult someone or not. Lots of choices all day long. The point of this story is humans make bad choices. That's it. There's no moral discussion here. The word sin does not occur until chapter 4. What this story is about is saying human beings make bad choices. But then you say, but they got the knowledge of Tov Vara'ah. Surely they'll make good choices now. No. Human beings are beset with the inability to make good choices all the time. I'm sure if we polled each of you, you would tell us about a bad choice that you've made within the last 24 hours. At least one. I have a list right here. It's too long. We don't have that time. This really puts the weight on each of us. We all intentionally make bad decisions, selfish decisions, decisions we know are contrary to what God wants from us. Paul puts it, for all have sinned. The Hebrew Bible doesn't deal with sin at this point. Rather, the Hebrew Bible is a book about choosing. Joshua says to the people, choose you this day whom you will serve. Deuteronomy, Moses in Deuteronomy says, choose life. It's all about making a choice in the Hebrew Bible. It's all about the ethics. It's all about figuring out what to do. And every time the Hebrew Bible knows we don't do it well. We can make really good choices. I'm sure you have a list of the good choices you've made. But we tend towards bad choices. It just is part and parcel of who we are. So why are we here? Why are we here? Because we make bad choices. You make bad choices. I make bad choices. Even Adam made a bad choice, and everyone since then has made bad choices. Everybody. Has anybody figured out, if we're looking at the movie Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, what the reference is? Right at the end, the guy drinks it, and the old knight says, oh, it's one of my favorite lines, he chose poorly. It's a great line, yes. He made a bad, selfish choice. He chose poorly. What happened to him? Instead, what did he expect to happen to him? To live forever. What happened to him? He got old really fast. Do you see what that is in the narrative? Instead of living a long time young, you live a short time really old and die. It's a reversal of what he wanted. Now move to the next part of the Genesis story. Chapter 3, verse 8 begins, and I'll just kind of move on through this. So they heard the sound of Elohim walking in the breezy part of the day, and the humans hide. So immediately, by the way, they had already sewn together, they had already put fig leaves together to cover themselves because they had already figured out, hey, I know good from evil, or I know good and bad, and I know I'm naked, and I'm somehow not comfortable with that anymore. And so that's what they do. Already their knowledge is something that they got that they didn't expect. They once were naked and unashamed, and now they is naked and ashamed. Do you hear the reversal? So they hide. God finds them again. So we don't have time to do that. The man, everybody blames everybody else. Welcome to our world. But getting to 3:14, now we have the consequences of this decision. We've already seen some. They're shamed. They're hiding. Okay? So the consequences. So first he talks to the snake. Because you have done this, now, the humans were Arumim. The snake was Arum, clever, the most clever of any wild animal that God had created. And now, because you have done this, says God in 3:14, Arur you are. It's marvelous in the Hebrew. Arur are you. He doesn't say, I curse you. He says, more cursed are you than any other animal, domestic or wild. On your belly you will crawl and you will eat dust all the days of your life. Well, see, once upon a time, the snake had legs. No. Think about it for just a moment. Think in light of he was the most clever of all the animals. Now picture what he's doing and tell me what he is. Once was the most clever. Now he's crawling on his belly and eating dirt. Now he's the most humiliated. It's a reversal. It's not about a snake, a lizard losing legs and becoming a snake. Doesn't have anything to do with whether he can talk anymore. The story just ignores that. What it is, it's a reversal from the most clever to the most humiliated. In the ancient world, how do you humiliate a foe? You make them crawl on the dust in front of you, on their bellies. That's how you do it. And that's the idea here. So now the snake is humiliated. Then I will put hostility, this is something that Yahweh says he's going to do, between you and the Isha, and your offspring and her offspring. He will shuf, the Hebrew word, he will, whatever word you put in the first part of this, you put in the second. He will grab, he will grip, he will snatch. That's really the Hebrew word. It has to do with this rather than beating up. It could be strike, but that's a rarity in that. He will shuf you in the head, and you will shuf him heel. It's the other way around. I don't know why my translation, the heel and the head. So he's going to grab you down here on the heel, and you're going to step on his head. So who wins? The human. At the end of the day, the human's going to win. But all your life and all your offspring, you're going to be having this fight between snakes and people. What was their relationship before? The snake and the animals and the people. Seemed to be okay. She walked up, he talked, we're fine. Now we have enmity between us. And that's only going to get worse after the flood, when all the animals suddenly become afraid of people. This is the first one. So the snake's position and relationship is reversed. To the Isha, to the woman, he said, great, and now this translate, your translations rarely translate what's in the Hebrew. It's very odd, and a lot of scholars have mentioned this. Greatly I will multiply your toil, etzev, your toil and your pregnancies. Not your pain in childbirth. That's not what the Hebrew says. It's a conjunction. I will increase your toil and your pregnancies. In toil, you will bring forth children. You will raise them up. Parents, raising children. Toil? Don't answer that. Your children may see you. Yeah. Where once, what was one of the commands? Human beings were supposed to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. It was supposed to be a nice, easy thing. And now, I'm going to make you have lots of children, and each of them are going to be toil. Toil, toil, toil. That which was supposed to be natural now is toil, both in the pain of childbirth and in the pain of rearing children. It's toil. Wow, there's a reversal. Once upon a time, you're just supposed to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Great. Now it hurts and hurts and hurts and hurts. It's toil. Don't lose that word. Hard work. To the human, he said, because, and now this is one of many male folks' favorite lines, you listen to the voice of your Isha, and we say, see, men are not supposed to listen to their wives. Wrong. Read the rest of the verse. You listen to the voice of your Isha, you ate from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, do not ever eat from it. What's the balance here? You listen to the voice of your Isha instead of listening to what I had already told you. That's the point of this. You listen to a human rather than listening to me. You knew what I said, and you chose what the human said. You made a choice. This is not about women should keep their mouths shut. I'm just hoping my wife heard that somewhere. Yeah, it's not. It's okay, men, to listen to your wives. Sometimes they have really good ideas. And sometimes they try to get you to put on green socks instead of blue. And you say, I shouldn't have listened to you. And then you change socks. Anyway, I'm sure I'll catch for that later. So That's the point. You did what I told you not to do. Notice, I commanded you, and in the Hebrew, it's singular. I don't know how the woman found out, but he only commanded the human, the original guy. So then, notice what happens. Arur, cursed, is the Adama. O Adam, cursed is the soil, cursed is the ground because of you. Yeah, isn't that wonderful? You caused this to be cursed. Happy day. By the way, what was he supposed to do? How was he supposed to treat the land, the garden? To preserve it and protect it. Ooh, look what's happened. Instead of being preserved and protected, it's now cursed. Oh, happy day. All the days of in toil, there's that same word we saw for the woman, in toil you will eat from it. All the days of your life, in the sweat of your brow you will eat until you return to the Adama, to the ground that we just cursed because of you, because from it you were taken, because dust you are, and to dust you will return. So now, that what he was supposed to be cultivating, protecting, and look at how that turned out. It's cursed, and now he's basically going to eat thorns and thistles. You'd see that a little bit later. You're going to eat, it's going to be terrible. What should have been easy is now terrible. Toil. What should have been fat, toil. It's all reversed. And now at the end of this, because you're going to go back to the dust one of these days. Did he die that day? No. No, he really didn't. As a matter of fact, he died 700 or so years later. So if you're going to make it, oh, that day is a long time. Yeah, it is 700 years. Yeah. But you will die. That's going to happen to you. So then you have the naming of the woman, because she is going to be the mother of all life, be fruitful and multiply. And then Yahweh Elohim makes garments. So you can see how you've made garments and made garments. We have this section is in the middle, and it's important, and it's set off by that. So everything has been reversed. The order of God, the order that God had intended for the human to maintain, has clearly shifted back to a more chaotic world. Instead of order, we now are back to chaos. The snake was the best and is now the most humiliated. The snake's relationship with the human, the woman, is now negative and violent. By the way, at this point in time, still everyone's a vegetarian. In Sunday school, we'll talk about that. The woman will have the be fruitful and multiply reversed. Now children are nothing but toil. The woman's relation to her counterpart, companion, I skipped over that. His desire will be for you. We can talk about that in Sunday school because that's the phrase where sin first comes up in chapter 4. It's repeated. But the woman's relationship to her counterpart, her companion, will now be negative and power-based rather than simply complementary, simply companioning. Adam causes the soil from which he was taken to be cursed. His task as a gardener will now be toil. Adam will eventually die. Wasn't he going to die anyway? Wait, there's a little bit more. The garden's not a perfect place. So, back to our Indiana Jones movie. Notice even in that movie, he drinks the cup, and what he had expected our bad guy is reversed. So there's one more issue that needs resolution in this story. We've already heard it read. It's our key passage. The third problem, we've seen God now, he needs a gardener, he needs a companion, and now he has another problem that he needs to solve. 3:22, then Yahweh Elohim said, see, the human has become like one of us, in that he knows Tov and Ra'ah, which, if you'll remember, is exactly what the snake said he'd get. He got exactly, he, it, the human, the woman, the man, got exactly what they asked for. Don't miss that. And the consequences of getting that knowledge are to have everything reversed. Johnny, tell them what they won. Well, look at what they won. They won a complete reversal of what they had. Because why? Disobedience, yeah, but it's also they now have the knowledge. They have this knowledge, and notice how God feels about them having this knowledge. What if he stretches out his hand and also eats from the tree of life and then lives to Olam, lives forever, lives... What then? Hear the problem? If we leave him in the garden, he's going to grab a hold of that tree of life and he will forever be this way, making bad decisions, having this knowledge that doesn't seem to help him. Well, God is evil and nasty and bad, and so he throws him out of the garden. No, God is trying to protect him from getting locked into a place where he only makes bad decisions. So we're not going to let him live forever. We're going to kill him off. Well, that's harsh. We in the New Testament understand what the point is, so that then something else can happen. But each of us makes bad decisions. Each of us always has. So then he drives out. He cast him out of the Garden of Eden to cultivate the Adamah from which he was taken. And he drives out the human. He places guardians there, the cherubs. We can take a look at pictures of those in Sunday school. The flaming sword and whatnot to guard the way. He can't go back in. Indiana Jones, what happens to the chalice at the very end? Everything crashes down and no one has it anymore. The way is barred. So why are we here? Why are we here? Because God could not allow us to live forever in this condition. Clearly, the idea in the text is only by eating of that fruit do you live forever. So, were Adam and Eve going to die? Of course they were, unless they ate of the fruit. And so God's answer was, well, we're not going to let them eat the fruit. We would have, apparently. So, why are we here? Because we choose to make selfish and contrary decisions. Because the consequences reverse what was supposed to be. And because God could not allow us to live forever in the condition of having knowledge and an inability to use it properly. So why are we here today? We still know Tov and Ra'ah. We still have that wisdom. Whether you know it or not, you're not naive. And you still make selfish and bad decisions. We still live in a reversed world. We still no longer have access to the tree of life. We're all gonna die. And maybe we think, oh, that might not be a bad thing rather than living forever in this condition. So is there an answer to all these answers? We can admit, first and foremost, that we do make bad decisions. Notice this is not a story of the devil made me do it. She chose. We need to be upfront. We need to be honest about those decisions that we make that are bad and wrong, that are contrary to good, that are hurtful, that are detrimental. We need to take ownership of them. That's what the text calls us to do. We are like Adam and Eve. Every one of us has gone their own way. We still live. But having done that, we are not left in a morass. We can then make one good one. One good decision to allow the one who made no bad decisions and yet was human to be at the center of our lives, to allow Christ to rule in our lives. We can allow the Spirit of God to come along inside of us, to come alongside of us and seek his guidance in all our decisions. We can do that. We have access to the Spirit of God to be able to say, what decision is best here? I'm really lousy at making decisions. Help me. This is one real way to break the power of sin in our lives. We can seek at every turn to reverse the reversals. maybe, just maybe, good decisions have the same reversing power that bad decisions have. Maybe a hug at the right time will reverse something. Maybe a word fitly spoken. Maybe a gift. Maybe you put in what you need to. Maybe good decisions can, in fact, reverse some of the bad, some of the evil, some of the negative, at least in the sense of helping one another. No, you're not going to transform the world into heaven, but maybe you can bring a little tiny piece of that heaven to someone today by a good decision. Seeking to change lives and situations of those around us for the better. Once again, connecting with God as was originally intended to bring order out of the chaos. Look around and look at people who are in chaos. Can you help bring order to them by good decisions? We can then live life finally and fully with the certain knowledge that at one point we will be allowed to taste of the tree of life. We will get back to there, and we will, through the blood of Christ, through the work of the Spirit, through our working with God, grab a hold once more of that tree, take a bite, and live forever in a new condition, the condition before we made bad decisions. And that's my prayer, that we would all connect in to that reality. Would you pray with me? Our gracious God, we thank you for the pattern, for the model, for the view of what you intended. We thank you that you have shown us what we have done. And we thank you that you have provided a way out. We thank you for the work, the blood, the redemption that you have provided for us, that we might once again taste of the tree of life in a new and redeemed life. In Jesus' name, amen.